warm welcome to the program. As you know, this is Red Ice Creations Radio, and I am your host, Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden, up in Scandinavia. And we are at the edge of November 2007 already. I'm glad you're here, and tune in either through our website, redicecreations.com, or through our podcast or some other way. Either way, it's good. I'm glad you're here. Today we're going to have a book tips program, basically. We have AJ Bruno from oneheartbooks.com back on the program. We had AJ with us in July this year and did a two-part program on mind control, EMF weaponry, and much more. And that program is available, by the way, in our archive for everyone that missed that show. And for today's program, AJ have picked out a few books, a few recommendations that we're going to talk more about. We're mainly going to focus on three books, three different titles. First, we have Michael Hoffman's Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. We have Mustafa Gadala's The Ancient Egyptian Roots of Christianity. And we also have Eckhart Tolle's book, The Power of Now, that we're going to talk more about. So I want to say welcome to our guest again. Hi, AJ. Good to have you back on the program again.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be here.
How are you, and how are things going over there at oneheartbooks.com?
Yeah, things are going real good. Sales have picked up since the show I've done with you. I've done a few other shows on some other radio shows that go out over the net. Yeah, things have been going good. It's been keeping me busy.
Excellent. Sounds good. Again, I'm glad to have you back. I think we can begin here today and talk about Hoffman's book, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. I've been going through a few chapters in this book, and what I found very interesting was that he wrote about in the initial pages about the Millennium Celebration that actually took place 1 year too early. You know, the whole thing that the new millennium actually begins in 2001 and not 2000. Anyway, he wrote a little bit about Arthur C. Clarke and Kubrick's 2001 and tied this together with that mysterious monolith that popped up in Magnuson Park in Seattle, apparently just a few hours into the new millennium in 2001. He also mentioned the new, you know, emerging transgenic sciences that now seems to be kind of merging with so many other fields of basically weird science and magical technology, something that we've been following with great interest on Red Ice Creations for a while now. So I found that book very interesting, and I'm looking forward to reading more from it. But I want to know a little bit about what you think about the book, AJ.
Yeah, I think this book is extremely key because of the insight that he brings to the whole agenda and how it's unfolding in regards to this end scenario that they're looking to manifest through creation, or through the creation of, you know, what they call the new man. And, you know, you have the beast man, and he talks about the, you know, the psychological aspects of how they're going about doing this through influencing the subconscious of the masses.
Yeah.
And he calls that the revelation of the method, which I believe he'd taken from James Shelby Downard, was the one who coined that this whole term here, the revelation of the method.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's really a really an important book, because I think one of the things that he points out in it is that most people who are into this research believe that it's just the exposure that's enough with all this, and he says that's not the case, because eventually, as he states on the one page here, that it's a page 17, he makes a reference to this Rosicrucian manifesto called the Confessio Fraternitatis, which means Confession of the Laudable Fraternity of the Most Honorable Order of the Rosy Cross. And he says that when we reach this point where we're at now, this 2001, and makes reference to Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, that we're entering into this, what he he calls a hermetic game of hazard or chance, you know, 21.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that they would want to expose themselves to the public and do it in such a way that they're ritually bound.
Hmm.
So that when they come out and have all this, you know, have the people know what's going on, that the people feel that there's nothing they can do, you know, that they're trapped into this thing.
What you're saying here, AJ, is that people actually could break out of it, but they had this psychological hold on people, meaning that they can't or don't dare to break out, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's a jip. I mean, it's a mind game, a trick that people are, you know, being led into.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That's what that is. You know, it's really about perspective, I find, with all this research. You know, it's about the perspective and insight and having an understanding of it. Exposure is certainly not enough here.
Mm, you're saying that,
It's the whole... I'm sorry, go ahead.
You're saying that exposure is kind of the first level, and then you need to, go further?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, definitely. And, you know, when you get into exposure, you better have a whole picture there. You just can't play these limited hangout type of games and not consider certain things, which,
sure.
What, you know, some researchers out there do, that they won't touch certain subjects. And, you know, sometimes I feel it's very telling when you have researchers who aren't willing to go and discuss certain areas that are, you know, that are definitely there. The facts are there to prove it.
Sure, sure. I mean, again, it's obviously everyone can't touch upon everything, and there is just not enough time, considering that there is so much information out there. But I hear what you're saying. I mean, some people do what they do, and they do that very well. But I guess on a personal level, if I'm interpreting this right, what you're saying here is that it's important also to take one step further, or you know, being willing to broaden your horizons, basically.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, if you're thinking about playing a game of chess, you're going to have to watch the whole army of your opponent. Because if you don't, if you're just watching half of it or this piece or that piece, then you're going to get hit with another piece from another end. And I think that's the thing that has to be understood here.
Mm-hmm. So Hoffman dives a little bit deeper into this, I guess, and takes it to the next level, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. He gets into the, you know, what we mentioned, the revelation of the method. And let me see here. I'll read a little bit from the book here, where he has a section titled Mind Control and a Revelation of the Method.
Mm-hmm.
It is here necessary to point out a fallacy which has succeeded in defeating many genuine ecological rebels against modern tampering and the occult philosophy and organization which powers it. These are a rare breed to begin with, since the vast majority of researchers who start out in search of the truth about these big themes end, like so many other avant-garde thinkers and activists, succumbing to the egregious tyranny and mind-napping that lurks beneath the facade of the liberal cult operation.
Hmm.
But if you escape this net only to blunder blindly into another, they become trapped in the fallacy that exposure of the methods and personal involved in the cryptocracy's crimes is, by itself, a tremendous step toward overthrowing the power of the cryptocracy. If only we could get some of the facts out in the open, is their refrain. I would reply that the process of hermetic cryptocracy is not stagnant. It is engaged in a remarkable project set into motion millennia ago, an operation which has accomplished most, if not all, of its chief goals with masterful dispatch. In the beginning of the Middle Ages of this operation, the hoodwink was a key to accomplishment of objectives. Generally speaking, deception is far less necessary today. Quite the contrary, the cryptocracy has actually been determined to reveal many of its greatest secrets to us profane ones for some time now. Veteran independent occult investigators were astonished at the massive disclosure in the 1970s of some of the deepest and most profound secrets of the Masonic Neoplatonic Hermetic Academy, secrets reserved in some cases for thousands of years for only the highest initiates. Two books by the English writer and Ordo Templi Orientis initiate Kenneth Grant, the previously cited Magical Revival and Aleister Crowley and the Hidden God, and another by the aforementioned Robert K.G. Temple, The Serious Mystery, revealed secrets of the highest magnitude which have been vigorously protected and hidden at some cost to human life for centuries. And in the case of Temple's book, Millennia, these books are published with the knowledge and approval of the Masonic Hermetic heirs to this knowledge. Independent researchers have seldom noted the significance of these revelations coming from occult groups and even advertising agencies which, in a demonstration of a macabre nose-thumbing at our complete indifference to our mental enslavement, have actually pointed to the subliminals in their own liquor ads. These actions signal our entrance into an entirely different era of alchemical process. In the brilliant wordplay of the mythical Masonic figure Dr. Syntax, we come to the current enfoldment in must be, an alchemical Kant language code term Mr. Downward translates as the revelation of the method. This alludes to the process wherein murderous deeds and hair-raising conspiracies involving wars, revolutions, decapitations, secret archaeo-astronomic deity cult worship, and every manner of horror show are first buried beneath a cloak of secrecy, and then, when finally accomplished and secured, slowly revealed to the unsuspecting populace who watch, deep-frozen, as the hidden history is unveiled. In the circulation of anti-academy manuscripts, the revelation of the method is accomplished. Truth or consequences. Downward is acutely aware that exposing the conspirators, he is probably serving the final dictum in their alchemical formula.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Indeed. You know, I just punched up James Shelby Downward here. As a reference that you mentioned here, and you're right, he wrote that King Kill 33 Masonic Symbolism in the Assassination of J.F. Kennedy. And he also has an interesting other thing here he mentions, and I know that Hoffman talks about this, something they called the Twilight Language. Have you heard about this?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty interesting. Is this, you know, especially in the last paragraph that you read there, I guess that would be referring to what is known as the Twilight Language, about the occult symbolism that is going on, you know, out in the open, basically, and those who can read that language, you know, understand it, you know, and knows what's going on, I guess.
Yeah, he uses the Jack the Ripper murders, the Son of Sam, you know, the serial type of killer murders as examples to explain this Twilight language and all the little symbolisms and things like that are placed and covered in the media when these things unfold.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing in the one, the shooting that went on at Virginia Tech.
Sure.
You know, that Twilight language was there with the, you know, the 33 total dead. And
that's right.
All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. That's right. The question is, though, I guess, what one wonders when you hear something like this is, I wonder if this always has been going on, but the fact that we actually do have a totally different structure of how information is disseminated now, and we have a lot of reporters, you know, the entire globe is filled with news agencies and reporters everywhere, and this is the fact that this comes through the news wires, all of these events, and those who can read the language and know the numbers and so forth, to them this is like, shit, they're doing it in the open now, but this might actually always have been going on. What do you think?
It's quite possible. But I mean, I feel in the past that definitely what he was saying, that they would protect these kind of things and, you know, kill people over them. There was that one, what was his name? I forget. Morgan?
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring a bell? The one guy who was murdered by the Masons in the early beginning days of America.
Oh yeah, he was the first one who revealed some of the initiatory, you know, the process, basically, I guess.
Right.
He's
murdered for that, but nowadays you have, you know, Masons out there talking about these kind of things themselves.
Sure.
So mm-hmm. I definitely feel that they've, you know, that in this point in the game, for them to do what they're doing, this makes complete sense to me, what he's bringing forth in this book, because in this 2001 time, which is the marking
mm-hmm.
for all this to start, they have to bring themselves out into the open to really legitimize and get people to accept, you know, entering into this you know, final end thing that they're trying to put together, their global system.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And they would have to do it in such a way that the people were, you know, as he points out in the book, they're ritually bound. You know, they're suffering from, you know, a sort of Stockholm syndrome.
Sure. That's interesting. Yeah, definitely. You know, so we mentioned the Twilight language, and 2001 again, as you say, seems to be a key date, or you know, obviously it's the new millennium. It's a, you know, this hasn't happened for 1,000 years. Something new is going in now, and something new is happening. And I know that also that Hoffman do talk a lot about the and is very worried about the, you know, the new technologies that are coming out, and all the you know, I think he refers to it as bestiality. I think you mentioned that too, the new transgenics and all the new sciences, and it seems to be that he's kind of hinting towards the fact that this is not the millennium of the human being anymore, but of something different, or something new that you mentioned, and I guess that they refer to that as the new man, right?
Yeah, that's it, the new man, the beast man. You know, the cyborg, you know, and you can see it with all the entertainment. I mean, I watched it myself in the 90s. It was like they were sort of tilling the soil for this new millennium, where they were, you know, in America, slowly slipping in these things that were demoralizing the people, and a lot of people are just eating it up.
Mm.
You know, the sexual promiscuity, just that the killing and these immoral type of anti-ethical ideas that kept on being slipped into the television and the news programming. Today it's all over the place.
Mm, yeah. That's
you know, it's,
mm, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, you know, recently up in my area, there's this new bread store. You know, it's like a cafe type of thing. They make bread, salads and things of that sort, but it's called Panera.
What was it called?
Panera.
Okay,
And if you take the two, you know, on their symbol, you can search out their website, and you can look at their logo, and on their logo, they have this woman carrying a loaf of bread, but if you look at the slits that are on the bread, they're 3 sixes.
Hmm, all right, yep, there we go.
And if you have the, you know, I'm sure the woman is a part of the virgin symbolism.
Mm.
And since she's carrying the bread, it most likely has to do with the goddess Ceres.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Which ties into the star Spica, which is the wheat sheaf in Virgo's hand.
Hmm.
And then we have all that goddess symbolism, and we have serial, you know, serial murders with the S, and then serial murders with the C.
Hmm.
As being sacrifices to the goddess.
Sure, that's right. Well, I think it was in Homer's Odyssey, the Ceres, she was the one who transformed men into pigs and fed off of them, I think. I think
that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that what they're doing?
Yeah, it definitely seems like it. And yeah, that's an interesting point. What I want to return to, I guess, is to just that idea of if this is the time of also when these kind of things actually are coming to the surface. On one level, they're obviously, you know, getting more bold, so to speak, but also we might be the fact that we're in a time now when these things can't be kept hidden, and that isn't the purpose of them. And finally, when they are revealed like this, we also get the opportunity then to actually see what is going on ritually or magically or however we want to term that, but that also gives us an opportunity to actually not participate in that. And I, for one, think that that is a good thing, that you actually can see it so clearly and, you know, you can become more aware of it, basically.
Yeah, that is if you've educated yourself on it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's the effects, you know, someone watching a symbolically occult-rich film. You know, there's the difference between the person who has no knowledge of it and how all that stuff is going into their subconscious and affecting them, and then there's the difference of the person who is knowledgeable of it and watching it, because then it can all be filtered through the conscious mind.
That's right.
So I think there's a difference there, and that's definitely why being educated on these subjects and these times is definitely important, because it gives us the opportunity to be aware of these things and make that choice.
That's right. And I guess that you would say that Hoffman's book help you in that process to become more aware of the language, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely does that, and I think it's also a key point in deciphering, you know, the good research that's out there being done, and some of the researchers who are falling into traps or deliberately. A part of this revelation of the method, as far as another Hegelian dialectic playing out in regards to just this research going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See what you mean. Okay, so AJ, what do you think? Do you want to move on and talk a little bit about the next book so we have time to get to them all here?
Yeah, we can move on to the next one. One thing I wanted to make mention of was the title of the Pan Era.
Mm-hmm.
If you consider that name and split it up, you have the Pan, the god Pan, which is the half man and, what was it, half goat?
I think so, yeah.
So that's the beast man.
Mm-hmm.
Pan era, we're entering into this new era of theirs.
The age, the era, yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
That's right.
And that's like a chain, at least I believe in the northeast area of the United States. Maybe it's a little bit further out in other places, but, you know, a chain like that just doesn't pop out of nowhere.
Sure, that's right.
You know, without the money and the backing, so, all the brotherhood symbolism is right there. It's definitely one of their operations.
That's interesting. Pan-Era Bread, I have to link that up in case I can find a website or something about that. Interesting.
Yeah, it's out there. They have one. It's Pan-Ear. I think panera.com.
Okay, so again, the book that we've been talking about there is Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare by Michael A. Hoffman II, and we're going to have that also linked up on Red Eyes Creations, and with a link to oneheartbooks.com, where you can get that book in case you're interested. Very, very interesting book, and seems to be very much in there for people to dive into become more aware, as AJ said, of the language, not only the Twilight language, but also what's going on in regards to psychological warfare and so forth. We also have another book that we're going to talk a little bit about, called The Ancient Egyptian Roots of Christianity by Mustafa Gadala. I've not read this book myself, and I don't know that much about Gadala, but AJ, I know that you've been going through the book here. What do you think of the book?
Yeah, I think it's a really good book. He definitely illustrates the connection that Christianity has in Egypt, and even Judaism. I know Michael Tessarian's been on the show talking about Akhenaten and Moses and all those kind of connections there. And he gets in here and talks about this and says that, Gadala is talking about this here, that he's saying that Moses was Akhenaten, Egyptian pharaoh that ruled from 1367 to 1361. King David was King Thutmosis, 1490 to 1436 BC. And Solomon was King Amenhotep III, which was 1405 to 1367 BC. And he goes through and illustrates the similarities between these characters and the real life pharaoh and the mythological, character of King Solomon, King David, and Moses. And it's definitely interesting because he gets him and says that all these things that we find in the Bible, all these stories, have their roots in Egypt in regards to real things that were taking place.
A passage here from the preface that I found pretty interesting. The new religion which was preached there by Saint Mark and his immediate followers in all essentials so closely resembles that which was the outcome of the worship of Osiris, Isis, and Horus. The similarity is noted by Budge and everyone who has compared the Egyptian Osiris, Isis, Horus allegory to the Gospel story are striking. Both accounts are practically the same, e.g. the supernatural conception, the divine birth, the struggle against the enemy in the wilderness, and the resurrection from the dead to eternal life. The main difference between the two versions is that the Gospel tale is considered historical, and the Osiris-Isis-Horus cycle is an allegory. The spiritual message of the ancient Egyptian allegory and the Christian revelation is exactly the same. That's pretty interesting. Do you think Gedalla makes a good case out of the story, so to speak?
Yeah, I think he does. He does. It really shown me, because I've read the Bible some years ago, the whole thing.
And
it really shows me where the truth, because there's truth in the Bible. There's really some spiritual wisdom, and it shows me where it's coming from.
Sure.
And, the Egyptian teaching must have came from somewhere else as well, most likely one of the pre-Diluvian civilizations, be it Atlantis or Lemuria. Let me just read from it here. It's a section called The Historical Absence and Gospel's Prominence. Despite the gospel story of the biblical Jesus, there has never been, number one, any archaeological evidence corroborated, and number two, any Roman record that can bear witness directly or indirectly to the gospel story of Jesus. Any corroboration to the gospel story in the writings of Jewish authors living at that period in Jerusalem or Alexandria. Number three, there were some attempts to add some references to Jesus of the Gospels at a later date to some of the writings of Jewish authors. However, such attempts have been exposed as forgeries produced either by Christians who wish to validate the historicity of their Lord or enemies of Christianity who wish to attack the religion. The usual response to the historical absence of the biblical Jesus is that he was an ordinary man and not an important figure to warrant any attention or place in his history. The Bible itself provides the contrary evidence to such a discredited claim. And he goes and cites Herod, the king of the time, in the story, going out to want to kill the firstborn.
Yeah.
And cites a bunch of parts where where there are these important, indicators that he just wasn't just somebody who wasn't important and wasn't important to write about.
Yeah.
And in the book, he does make a reference to a similarity between the Herod wanting to go murder him and the story in regards, the allegory in regards to the birth of Horus and Set wanting to go out and murder Horus.
Sure.
During that birth, at least in that allegory.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely one thing to keep in mind, is that the story of Osiris, Isis, and Horus is an allegory. It is not real individuals.
Yeah. That's
interesting. But it does, make the reference in this book, as I was stating earlier, that these pharaohs, Akhenaten, Amenhotep, and what is the other one here? Thutmose.
Thutmose, yeah.
You know, were these real life characters who some of these Old Testament characters were based upon.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many allegories, and I think a lot of people have picked up on this. I know that Ralph Ellis talks a little bit about this, and as I mentioned, I think Michael Tesserin also picks up on this, of course, and Jordan Maxwell has obviously done his homework on this kind of where mythology and religion kind of intersects and all of this. I don't know if you had the time to see the movie Zeitgeist a while back. It's pretty popular on the web, at least, you know. They kind of dived into this.
I watched that one.
You did, yeah, the first part.
Yeah.
So this material is definitely, you know, it's out there and it's very, very interesting, and it seems to be coming to the light more and more. You know, we can compare the different mythologies, and I think there were like 13 or 16 in total of the what they call the crucified saviors, and I think Horus also was considered to be one of these. You know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he makes mention of that in the book here that that Horus was hung on a tree.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the same thing, you know, they say in the Bible that, Jesus was hung upon a cross, but he goes and makes some references from the Bible and the Talmud that it states that also that Jesus was hung on a tree.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it's pretty difficult to, at this point, to sort out what actually has happened and what hasn't happened, and what is just, you know, story after construction or whatever. But again, there's so many different varieties to this. Do you think, I don't know if Mustafa Gadala goes into this anything in the book, but is there any kind of, you know, does he write about anything of the spiritual messages of the, either if we look at the Jesus story or the Horus story, you know?
Yeah, he does. This is what the... After he covers all the, in part two of the book called The Historical Christ King, he covers the similarities between the both mythologies. And then he gets into a third part here, which is called the Egyptian Christian Essence. And he talks about these, the similarities between the teachings of Jesus and the son of Akhenaten, Pharaoh Tutankhamun. And it says, the Christ of faith is rooted in the ancient Egyptian religion, as was sporadically demonstrated in the previous chapters. The rest of this book will focus on the major aspects of the religious essence, practices, and traditions of Christianity that were plagiarized of the Egyptian religion. The very thing that is now called the Christian religion was already in existence in ancient Egypt long before the adoption of the New Testament. The British Egyptologist E.A. Wallace Budge, in his book Egyptian Religion, Egyptian Ideas of Future Life, writes, the Egyptians possessed some 6,000 years ago a religion and a system of morality, which when stripped of all corrupt accretions, stand second to none among those which have been developed by the greatest nations of the world. Long ago, the ancient Egyptians believed in the coming of a Messiah, a Madonna, and her child, a virgin birth, and the incarnation of the Spirit in flesh. The ancient Egyptian texts reveal irrefutable proof that the entire body of Christian doctrine is simply a revamped and mutilated Egyptianism. The early Christian church accepted these ancient truths as the very tenets of Christianity, but disavowed their origins. Plagiarizing the Egyptian religion was noted by several brave writers, as you know, the British Egyptologist E.A. Wallace Budge and the Gods of the Egyptians. The new religion, which was preached there... Oh, well, this is what you just read in the beginning here. He repeats it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's pretty interesting, because also you start wondering, you know, we can see so much Egyptian symbolism in like royal regalia and stuff like this, and if indeed the story, the Christian story, was borrowed or, you know, transmuted or whatever, you know, morphed into the Christian Bible, one wonder also who the Bible was written for. Because, I mean, if we think about it, Gutenberg, who's, you know, didn't start printing the first versions of the Bible until like 1452 or something like that, I think, punched it up on Wikipedia. So about, you know, almost 1,000 years after Christianity was created, then the Bible became, you know, somewhat available to people who at least could read at that point. So it's pretty interesting, you know, to consider these things. If you know, what you mentioned earlier, of course, that a lot of, for instance, Masonic lodges and orders that are connections to the different royalties around Europe and elsewhere, that they have, you know, prominently featured the Bible in their lodges and stuff like this. So one does, you know, tend to think that there is knowledge that this story goes way, way back further, you know, than to around the year zero, you know?
Yeah, I definitely feel that the religions, you know, were created as a control mechanism for people, and I guess to trap them in ways. Because if you look at the twisting of things and some of the ideas, the fairy tales that people believe in, it in a way it fosters a split mind itself.
Hmm.
And there's definitely, I think, what they wanted to do as well is take the truth unto themselves and hide it from the people. That's why, you know, we don't know so much about Egypt, that it's kind of been hidden in history from us.
Mm-hmm.
And that they themselves have taken this truth that, you know, they've kept to themselves and twisted it to their own means, which it, at that point, it becomes corrupted, and it's not the truth anymore. It is, and it is not, and yet it still is. You know?
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting.
But there's... let me try and find this one part here where there are these negative confessions that, you know, they speak about here. He says, in a book of instructions, the Egyptian king advised his son, the prince, to attain the highest qualities, because upon his death he would see his whole lifetime in a single instant, and his performance on earth would be reviewed and evaluated by the judges. Even as far back as the period of the 6th dynasty, we find the idea that heaven was reserved for those who have performed their duty to man and to the divine powers while on earth. No exceptions were made to a king or anyone else.
Mm.
And that's as it is, you know, as the Gadal is saying, it's being taught in the Egyptian sense.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely exceptions being made for these elites.
That's right.
No.
Yeah.
And as stated earlier, ancient Egyptians expressed their metaphysical beliefs in a story form, like a sacred drama or a mystery play. The following are the Egyptian symbolic representation of the process of the judgment day. The soul is deceased and led to the hall of judgment of the double Maat. She is double because the scales balance only when there is an equality of opposing forces. Maat's symbol is the ostrich feather, representing judgment or truth.
Mm-hmm.
Her feather is customarily mounted on the scales. Anubis, an opener of the way, guides the deceased to the scales and weighs the heart. The heart, as a metaphor for conscience, is weighed against the feather of truth to determine the fate of the deceased. The seated grand ancestor, Osiris, presides in the Hall of Justice. The jury consists of 42 judges or excessors. Each judge has a specific jurisdiction over a specific sin or fault. The spirit of the deceased denies committing each sin before its assigned judge by reciting the 42 negative confessions. These negative confessions come from chapter 125 of the Book of the Coming Forth by Light, or what is more commonly known as the Book of the Dead.
Yeah, yeah.
The assigned juror or judge will declare his or her acceptance by declaring Ma Kuru, true of voice or action. And then he goes through and translates, gives the translations of these 42 negative confessions. And I'll just read a few of them, and they sound very similar to, you know, what we have today is the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
And number one is, I have not done iniquity. Number two, I have not robbed with violence. To continue, I have not stolen. I have done no murder. I have done no harm. I have not defrauded offerings. I have not diminished obligations. I have not plundered the Netaru. And he explains in the book that the Netaru is the all. And that to the Egyptians, the Netaru is the basically the one god, but all the different Egyptian gods in the cosmology were different qualities of that one god.
Yeah, yeah.
And he also explains that, in the book that Akhenaten threw away all these other qualities and just declared the Aten as the one god and pretty much created this sort of, I guess, spiritual fascism and mutilated a lot of the Egyptian teachings. And because of that, he was, you know, kicked out of Egypt.
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, if you read this here, it's saying that I have not done this or have done that. It's not saying thou shall not.
Yeah, there's a difference there, definitely.
Yeah, it's a very big difference.
Yeah.
It's subtle, but it's very, very big, very important.
Yeah.
Because you have the individual stating, I have not done, instead of this projection. And we find that when I mentioned the splitting of the mind in religions, it's not with a lot of people who are into these religions, you find that they exemplify that type of thinking where it's like, you know, you have to do this and you have to be this way and you have to have Christ in your heart and all this other kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But they don't live it themselves.
And I guess also if you go by a book that much, what I found is kind of, you know, weird with the whole thing is that you can always find things, you know, that are, what's the word I'm looking for here? excuse me, AJ, I'm just going to pull this out here. I can't believe I lost this word. You know, so many contradictions, that's the word I'm looking for, in the Bible. So you can basically state one thing and take an excerpt, let's say, from the Bible and say, you know, this, you shouldn't do this, or, you know, he did that, so that's an example, you know, that we should live by, or whatever. And then you can actually go in and probably draw out a total opposite against what just has been commanded or stated or said by someone. And I think that this also creates a very big split, and people, you know, can cherry pick at certain, you know, points basically from where they want to draw this information. And this, to me at least, kind of create this split, as you mentioned, because people go so much by the book that they don't anymore, you know, go by their own heart and decide what they want to do or how they feel about it. What do you think?
Yeah, they're no longer thinking about it. So in one verse, they're reading thou shalt not kill, and the next verse, they're reading about these, you know, exploits where they're going out and murdering people, you know. There's parts in the Bible where it says go out and murder everybody in the town.
Yeah, yeah.
Women, children alike.
That's right.
At that point, it's like nothing is really the actions of the person or the group is not even considered anymore. It's just, let's find a way to justify doing it.
Yeah, that's right.
Because now we have no reproach because we are this thing. We are Christians, or we are Muslims, or we are Hebrews or Jews.
Well, exactly. Again, it's more about identifying with that group than actually understanding what it is that you're a part of and what you're, you know, doing, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, the truth that's contained in any of these, you know, religious texts at that point are just disregarded and not even considered. And that's another thing that they do in regards is that they wouldn't, you know, even follow some of the law that says that you shouldn't have an idol before you.
Yeah.
Now, in some regards, we can't get that mixed up because, you know, we don't want to throw away a statue of maybe like a Hindu god in regards to, you know, how maybe a Hindu might see it as a teaching device.
Sure, sure.
You know, if we can see it as a teaching device, then it's not an idol.
Hmm.
It can be mistaken as an idol by someone else who doesn't understand what it is and what its function is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
But in regards to that, at the same time, you know, the Christians will say, well, we can't be materialistic and we can't have no idols before us, but the Bible itself has become an idol for them.
Sure, that's right, exactly. And there's definitely, again, all the, you know, even the crucifix itself, you know, is an idol right there, I think. And I think it's things do get kind of messed up when things are taken too literally, and you don't know, you know, what's up and what's down anymore if you do that.
Yeah.
I think it's important again to go by your heart and go by your own intuition and make your own mind up about these things. Do you think this book, The Ancient Egyptian Roots of Christianity by Mustafa Gadala, can help to kind of pinpoint that idea that this is a story that is more allegory, and there is, as you said in the beginning, more there are spiritual truth in this story, and certainly in the Bible as well. Do you think this book could help to kind of highlight that idea?
Yeah, he does. He does on page 99. He writes, "The cosmological knowledge of ancient Egypt was expressed in story form, which is a superior means for expressing both physical and metaphysical concepts. Well-crafted allegories are the only way to explain the deepest truths about God, creation, life, the soul, our place in the universe, our struggle to evolve to higher levels of insight and understanding. Any good writer or lecturer knows that stories are better than exposition for explaining the behavior of things, because the relationships of parts to each other and to the whole are better maintained by the mind. The Egyptian sages transformed common factual nouns and adjectives, indicators of qualities, into proper but conceptual nouns. These were, in addition, personified so that they could be woven into narratives. Storytellers were specially qualified people, for the word is mightier than the sword.
Oh, yeah.
Allegories are intentionally chosen as a means for communicating knowledge. Allegories dramatize cosmic laws, principles, processes, relationships, and functions, and express them in a way easy to understand. Once the inner meanings of the allegories have been revealed, they become marvels of simultaneous scientific and philosophical completeness and conciseness. The more they are studied, the richer they become. The inner dimension of the teachings embedded into each story make them capable of revealing several layers of knowledge according to the stage of development of the listener. The secrets, in quotes, are revealed as one evolves higher. The higher we get, the more we see. It is always there. The Egyptians did not believe their allegories as historical facts. They believed in them, in the sense that they believed in the truth beneath the stories."
Hmm. Yeah, there you have it. That's a very good point, I think. Huh, excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, that's The Ancient Roots of Christianity by Mustafa Gadala, and same thing goes there. AJ carries that on his website, and we're going to have that linked up as well. What I want to do now, AJ, is begin and talk a little bit about the last book that we're going to talk about here, The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. I know that you like Eckhart Tolle. You talked briefly about him and some of his works, his work last time you were on the program. And what I want to ask is, you know, in regards to The Power of Now, is there something special in this book that stands out to you, if we were to compare it with the rest of his work?
Mm. Yeah, each of his books are different, and yet, you know, in essence are the same. But what I like about The Power of Now is that he covers the dysfunction of the ego and how it works within people and how it operates. And he does it, you know, real, covers a lot of ground in regards to that and the power of now, but he covers that in all of his books. But this one, he does it more, I would say, concisely in regards to the covering the aspects of it and how it functions.
Mm-hmm.
Because to understand what is this, you know, I would call it a parasite in the mind, this ego. I don't believe it's intrinsic to us at all. To understand how it operates, you know, is real important to, you know, be able to kind of get a hold of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not running your life anymore.
Yeah.
You're the one who becomes in control of that in regards to the humbling it and, you know, putting it to sleep.
Sure.
Because much of this world, as far as I'm concerned, from reading the, you know, Eckhart Tolle's work, and in particular this book, The Power of Now, explains to me how the world is really manipulated. It's manipulated through the ego of people.
Hmm. That's through interesting.
The ego identification, and he covers that in the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I myself feel that the elite and those who are running, you know, the planet in regards to the way they are possessed by this ego.
Hmm. That's a good point.
It's this kind of collective egoic dance that is occurring. And, you know, he exemplifies in this book that the means are not inseparable from the end. Which is what these secret society networks, you know, they teach the opposite of that. That the means are justifying the end, or the end is justified by the means.
Hmm.
And he opens this book up with a little statement here that says, "You are here to enable the divine purpose of the universe to unfold. That is how important you are."
Hmm.
And, you know, in regards to, you know, we're talking about the Madala book, and, you know, he explains some of the roots and the ideas of where Christianity comes from, and he states in there about, you know, what maybe would be termed the Christ consciousness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that the Christ consciousness is not something that is only reserved for a few. It's something obtainable by the all, by
mm-hmm.
everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this Eckhart Tolle book, you know, could say he gets into that in regards to how the, you know, beyond the egoic mind, there is the self.
I think that's an important thing to point out and basically say again, because I think that the... you know, many have suggested that the ego is something that is kind of laid. In other words, the ego is not you, but there's you is behind that, or the ego is something that is applied above that construct of the mind because of, you know, whatever that might be. That, as far as we know, that's kind of a not a mystery perhaps, but it's difficult to pinpoint exactly what the ego is and why it arose to begin with. But what you're saying is that people shouldn't identify that that themselves are the ego, but that there is something more beyond that. And also, getting rid of the ego doesn't mean that you're getting rid of your own individuality and your own will, right?
No, not at all. Yeah, you're right there. To not be identified with the ego or the thinking mind, that he calls it, because he states the true intelligence arises from a place of no mind, where it's more coming from, you know, deeper within you. It's not tied up in all this thought about being stuck in the past
or the future. Yeah.
Because that's what happens. The mind can live in the past and can live in the future. And then what pops up is anxiety, or if you're living in the past, there's the guilt, there's the anger,
mm-hmm.
or the, you know, even in regards to doing this research, we look at this plan that's unfolding before us, and a lot of us know it.
Yeah, yeah.
See what's happening, And then we can look at the people who are sleeping and we can get aggravated at them and we can get stuck in the future thinking, oh, well, this plan is going to unfold because they got so much control of things and all these levers in their hands at this point.
Yeah.
And we can get angry.
Hmm.
At that point, we're living in the future.
That's right. We're living in a world that hasn't happened yet, right?
Right. And in that essence, that even plays into their hands because it helps them to even fulfill it.
Mm, that's a very good point. Hmm.
And I think that's why they promote a lot of this type of catastrophic thinking and the world type thinking, which is even hardwired into, you know, the Christian Bible, the Book of Revelation.
Sure, that's right.
You know, I mean, if people want an apocalypse and they're thinking one's coming, then of course they're going to provide one for them.
That's right. Sheesh.
But if no one showed up to an apocalypse, then how could it happen?
Mm, that's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, you know, he gets into talking about this is the power of now. When you're in the now, you tap into that, you know, what I would call the deep spring that's within us, that spiritual spring that can never, you know, be exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll read a little part here where he talks about the present moment.
Mm, sure.
The book's written in like a question and answer format, so there's a statement made where it says, the present moment is sometimes unacceptable, unpleasant, or awful. And Eckhart Tolle responds, it is as it is. Observe how the mind labels it and how this labeling process, this continuous shifting in judgment, creates pain and unhappiness. By watching the mechanics of the mind, you step out of its resistance patterns, and you can then allow the present moment to be. This will give you a taste of the state of inner freedom from external conditions, the state of true inner peace. Then see what happens and take action if necessary or possible. Accept, then act. Whatever the present moment contains, accept it as if you had chosen it. Always work with it, not against it. Make it your friend and ally, not your enemy. This will miraculously transform your whole life.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, that's an excellent passage also to pick or to read. Do you think that this kind of thinking or this ideas that Eckhart expresses here is how should I put it? A useful or a very, you know, good way to get some perspective if you're into a lot of, you know, conspiracy research and involved in a lot of this kind of information that, as you say, actually can get you very down at times.
Yeah. Yeah, it most certainly does give you perspective on yourself and, you know, on the collective situation as well.
Mm.
I think this is the work of Eckhart Tolle definitely needs to be looked into by everyone who's into this type of research and even people who aren't.
Sure.
You know, we all wish that everybody could be looking into this because the more people we have seeing what's going on in the world, the better. But even the people who don't even know about what's going on in the world, and this book would be good for them as well because it would take them out of the ego if they really put it into practice. Because you have to put it in practice. You can read all the books in the world, but if you don't, you know, put it into practice and integrate it into your lifestyle, it's not really worth much at that point. There's always a two-step process.
That's completely right. Absolutely.
But if just even the general public would remove themselves from the ego, then they would be less susceptible, if at all, susceptible to the manipulations that are occurring.
Yeah. That's a good point.
They need the people stuck in their egos. And Eckhart Tolle really opens the door and unlocks the door, opens it, and shows it to you. So this is the way out. And, I find, like, there's no manipulation, there's no type of guru stuff with him or anything of that nature. Is really a beautiful, truly enlightened man. You know, whatever you want to call it, be it Christ consciousness or anything else, you know, living in the Tao, having the Buddha awakened within you. I mean, all those things are just terms that are pointing to this this spiritual state that this man has attained. And he explains what happened to him. In the beginning of the book, he went through these intense states of anxiety, despair. I mean, he was constantly living in that type of thing. And then he started to realize that he had this, what was it, an insight about himself, about, you know, it seems like his mind was fighting back and forth. And the question was, you know, how many are there of me within myself? Are there two of me? And which one is real and which one isn't? And when that happened, the I guess the realization occurred, and whatever was driving him into these states of anxiety and severe depression just kind of dropped away.
Yeah.
And he fell asleep and then woke up enlightened. Or enlightened, and he went out and lived on the streets for so many years, just marveling at life, with this silent mind, just observing, you know, becoming the watcher. That's what he explains in regards to backing away from the ego, is not getting caught up in the whirlwind of it. You know, if you're, you can liken it to a sort of a tornado. The ego is like the tornado, or that's swirling around. But in the center is the stillness. The eye of the tornado is still.
That's a good analogy. Yeah.
If you can get into that center place and become the watcher, eventually you can dissipate the ego and the way it affects us and stuff like that, which causes us to project things onto others. Things that we do ourselves, we can project onto other people and blame them for it when we're doing ourselves. One of the things that we were talking about with what the religious folk can do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you get beyond that projecting thing into that place, and then you can live from a place of extension, where you're extending that same truth that's within all of us, that love, and then there's that resonance that occurs between people, you know, with the extension. And that's, there's some concepts that are mentioned in another book of the site, A Course in Miracles, the difference between projection and extension, but, you know, and totally references that book as well in The Power of Now. So, yeah, I'll read another excerpt here from the book about the ego.
Yeah, please.
And its attachments. It's from a chapter called Moving Deeply into the Now, a section, Don't Seek Yourself in the Mind. And the beforehand statement is, I feel that there's still a great deal I need to learn about the workings of my mind before I can get anywhere near full consciousness or spiritual enlightenment. And Tolle answers, no, you don't. The problems of the mind cannot be solved on the level of the mind. Once you have understood the basic dysfunction, there isn't really much else that you need to learn or understand. Studying the complexity of the mind may make you a good psychologist, but doing so won't take you beyond the mind, just as the study of madness isn't enough to create sanity. You have already understood the basic mechanics of the unconscious state, identification with the mind, which creates a false self, the ego, as a substitute for your true self rooted in being. You become as a branch cut off from the vine, as Jesus puts it. The ego's needs are endless. It feels vulnerable and threatened, and so lives in a state of fear and want. Once you know how the basic dysfunction operates, there's no need to explore all its countless manifestations. No need to make it into a complex personal problem. The ego, of course, loves that. It is always seeking for something to attach itself to in order to uphold and strengthen its illusory sense of self, and it will readily attach itself to your problems. This is why, for so many people, a large part of their sense of self is intimately connected with their problems. once this has happened, the last thing they want is to become free of them. That would mean loss of self. There can be a great deal of unconscious ego investment in pain and suffering. So once you recognize the root of unconsciousness as identification with the mind, which of course includes the emotions, you step out of it, you become present. When you are present, you can allow the mind to be as it is without getting entangled in it. The mind in itself is not dysfunctional. It is a wonderful tool. Dysfunction sets in when you seek yourself in it and mistake it for who you are. It then becomes the egoic mind and takes over your whole life.
Oh yeah, that's a very good point. Very good passage to read.
Yeah, the whole book is just, you know, he doesn't utter a word unless it has that, it is of this essence, because it's not like he's speaking from the mind. When he speaks, he's speaking from that enlightened place, that place within himself, and you can really feel that resonance, because I also have this up at the on the site as an audio book, and he reads it himself, and just by listening to his voice, the resonance, you know, I was mentioning the resonance earlier between that inner place within him extending outward, it resonates with the inner place within you. So when you're listening to him, just by listening to his voice, he can take you into that place.
Yeah, I remember there are a few videos available where he does a talk or a presentation or you know, and it's very interesting to listen to him. And I think we're originally born in Germany, so it has a bit of a special accent too, and it's very, very interesting, you know, with the way he reads, as you say, the pauses and all of this. And I definitely recommend people to check out, you know, some of those videos up there also. Have you seen a few of those? I think it's probably good to get an idea of who he is and what he talks about.
Yeah, there is like a list of videos that were, you know, set up at YouTube that I embedded into a page on my site. There's a whole section at the site called Inner Resources. And that's where I put up, you know, a lot of stuff from around the web, real things that I find that are important for other people to go and educate themselves.
Excellent. There
from the site for free, because that's what this is all about for me. It's about people getting educated. It's not so much about selling books.
Sure, sure. That's right. So
definitely, you know, I feel like I said before with some of the former shows, I think books are important because you're not dealing with the light of the computer, and there's definitely a different quality, a spiritual quality to books.
Yeah, that's
in
right.
In essence, to books that you can't get from the computer. And as well, I think it's important to have these books, you know, kind of spread out all over the place, so there's records and there's accounts in case there is some type of cataclysm, you know, in the future at some point, which is very well possible because it has happened in the past.
Sure, that's right, yeah.
But nothing to be scared over, you know, nothing to get freaked out about, just, you know, possibilities you have to keep in mind and consider at times.
Well, exactly, that's right. If it happens, it happens, but since it hasn't happened yet, there's no reason to worry about it.
Yeah.
That's a good good point. Yeah, okay, so that's a very good good idea to head on over to oneheartbooks.com and check out that the books that we've been talking about here today, and also check out that page with the videos with Eckhart Tolle on them. I want to, you know, before we round up this program here today, AJ, I want to leave the last few minutes to you so you can again mention, you know, the titles that we've been talking about here today, and also mentioned how people can get over to your website and, you know, get them.
Yeah, the website is oneheartbooks.com. It is all spelled out. And the books we were talking about today were Michael Hoffman's Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare. This book can be found in the Mind Control and the Secret Society section of the store. The second book we were discussing were The Ancient Egyptian Roots of Christianity by Mustafa Gadala. And I haven't placed this one in any section yet, so I have this miscellaneous title section at the store, so this is where you can find that one on the site until I get an idea to create a section for it, maybe an Egyptian section or something like that.
Yeah.
And the third book we were talking about was The Power of Now, and this one is also in the miscellaneous title section by Eckhart Tolle.
Excellent. So again, the website is oneheartbooks.com. AJ, I'm looking forward to having you back on the show. Again, I think this is very, very nice to break now and again on the regular programming and do a little bit of book tips for people, because there's so much out there to read, and there's so much out there to dive into, and it's good to get a few recommendations and ideas basically of what is out there.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely, these books need to be discussed, and people need to be made aware that they are in existence, and there's a lot of great individuals out there who have certain experiences and done research, and they have taken the time to put these books together for us. And,
yeah, that's right.
It's definitely important, because there's all this horrible stuff occurring. This is something else that Tolle mentions in one of his books about the paradox: as things get worse, they're also getting better.
Yeah.
And, a lot of these books and the knowledge coming out is certainly a part of things getting better.
That's right. Yeah.
And they've done a lot of hard work, and I don't quite remember specifically the quote that I have up on the homepage of the store, the Socrates quote, but he makes reference, make use of the books and written material that, men have, put out hard work to put together. Make use of those kind of things. It's important.
Well, exactly, before a new Fahrenheit 451 is upon us,
Yeah, right.
Sheesh. My God. Okay, so again, AJ, I want to say, thank you for coming on the program, and I'm looking forward to having you back on again. So thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a great time talking with you, my brother.
Thank you, and I also want to say thanks to everyone for tuning in to the program, and my thanks to Frederick behind the controls. Our website, as you know, is redicecreations.com, and this is Henrik Palmgren. Until next time, take good care, everybody. Goodbye.